Why bother spreading the truth about the nature of religion and religious origins? What's the potential benefit? What's to be gained or what's to be lost if ignorance continues? Currently, there's a messed up configuration of what religion is thought to be about, and the mind, such as with the 18-year-old to 22-year-old, the college-age mind, let's say, is driven by a natural attraction to the mystic intense altered state to discover for oneself what there is to be experienced. It's a being drawn towards religious revelation and making good on many of those things one has picked up along the way in church and in culture. We've heard about both religion, religious experiences, religious doctrine, drug experiences, and we also by that age may be dissatisfied with what we know so far and we're looking for more. We're looking, whether it's looking for kicks, looking for exploration and adventure, looking for self-knowledge, looking for truth, for satori, that the Eastern religions claim. We've seen the Buddhism magazines, heard about supposed spiritual mystical meditation there in Eastern practice, and clearly, as soon as one experiences the entheogens, it's obvious that that's the key and doorway right there to get at these things. Now, one may read a lot and read disparagement of that path, but it's self-evident without reading that, that this is something great and something that's a priority to explore and utilize. The potential benefit is thus a discovery of how the mind works and the ability to metaprogram and things like that. It's like discovering a user's manual to the mind and a microscope and a way of looking at the mind that one never had before. Clearly, one should be an explorer of one's mind that has general purpose advantages. And clearly, it connects to our religious traditions. Therefore, there is much intellectual fulfillment, including intellectual coherence to be gained, and self-understanding, and all of the values we've learned through school and cultural upbringing. Clearly, this is a way to make good the truth about the nature of religion and religious origins. The question it's really asking about when we say the nature of religion and religious origins, what we have in mind there really in that question is no Jesus and mystery religions and drug-based mystery religions. The question really expands to why bother spreading the truth? What's the truth? The truth about the nature of religion and religious origins. What's the potential benefit of knowing the entheogen truth and the esotericism truth? The entheogen slash esotericism truth, because the esoteric truth about religion is the entheogen truth. Jan Irvin and I would have a little different ideas leap to mind when you say the truth about the nature of religion and religious origins. My view on what that truth is summarized concisely in my main article, so why bother spreading the ego death theory, including the maximal entheogen theory of religion, and including Hymarmony and salvation from that and the nature of myth. For me, it's like asking, why bother spreading the ego death theory? What's the benefit of doing that? I've written a couple web pages on that. What's to be gained or what's to be lost if ignorance continues? That is, for me, that means what's to be gained from propagating the ego death theory? What's to be gained from propagating the ego death theory? And for Jan Irvin, it may mean what's to be gained from propagating the astrotheology, or his term archaeo-astrotheology or whatever. And what's to be lost if ignorance continues? For me, that means what's to be lost if ignorance about the ego-death theory continues. And for Jan, it may mean what's to be lost if ignorance about archaeo-astrology continues. There are many things that will be lost if the ignorance continues. There are many opportunities here to gain very much from propagating the ego-death theory and the maximal entheogen theory of religion. And ahistoricity of Jesus includes, the benefits include understanding the nature of the New Testament, which is the most predominant religion, culturally predominant religion now. Thus, the truth about the nature of religion and religious origins enables us to, for the first time, enables moderns to understand the meaning of the New Testament in its intended reading and intended context. That's one of perhaps two things that I would highlight. The benefit is understand the New Testament, and the benefit is understand the nature of religion as a revelation about the nature of personal control power and its hidden source from outside of the personal control system. What is the current state of entheogen scholarship? Has it stagnated? What's the worst aspect, the greatest lack of today's state of entheogen scholarship? Well, it always feels stagnant to me, though as the years, on a scale of 2 years perhaps, as every couple of years rolls by, there are a couple of books added to the library of books on entheogen scholarship. The book Shroom, Ruck's book Hidden World, Graham Hancock's book has been influential, Benny Shannon a few years ago, Ruck's other book about Eleusis recently, podcasts such as at least the Psychonautica podcast, a few books by the psychedelicists authors that are more present-oriented or 20th century-oriented rather than historical. For them, history means the starting from William James. The cannabis history book is recent and good. Has it stagnated? Well, there's the book about Wasson's contributions called Sacred Mushroom Seeker that has a strong stagnation aspect to it. The continuing lopsided praise of Wasson is definitely a kind of stagnation, definitely. Salvia has continued to spread in awareness, though that's not exactly entheogen scholarship. It may be more entheogen research. What's most lacking in today's state of entheogen scholarship? We lack the number of authors we need, the number of new books and articles we need, the penetrating presence within the glossy magazines on the newsstand is missing, Psychedelic Illuminations magazine is missing from the newsstand. There's an annual issue of Heads on psychedelics or entheogens, though again, I don't think it has much of an entheogen scholarship history aspect of ancient history or the entirety of Western history. There's a lack of Eastern religion as far as drug origins and ongoing wellspring, and to date, scholarship as represented by Ruck tends to still understate the extent of entheogen use throughout Christian and Western history and culture. So the moderate entheogen theory of religion continues to be overly predominant. The two views that are known to mainstream scholarship is especially the minimal entheogen theory of religion, which considers entheogens deviant or a practice of the other, heretical, rare, exceptional. And then what's considered the progressive edge really merely is lukewarm, the moderate entheogen theory of religion. And I'm striving to bring that moderate over into the maximal entheogen theory, to say that drug use was historically normal and not just deviant, not merely heretical, but mainstream in Christian origins and throughout Christian history. I put the tapering off point at the beginning of the modern era rather than at the end of antiquity. Why are so few scholars working on the problem of drugs in Christian history? Scholars are closed-minded to it. The non-entheogen scholars have settled on the view that it's far-fetched to imagine drugs in Christian origins. And then the entheogen scholars are not working on the problem of drugs in Christian history because they are committed to hating and demonizing and demolishing rather than understanding and recognizing Christian history, including the themes clearly indicating psychoactive Eucharist and psychoactive's use throughout Christian history and in Christian origins. The entheogen scholars, who you would think would get into that area, usually do not because they are far more committed to demonizing and criticizing in scorched earth fashion Christianity and insisting that it, or blaming it for stamping out drug use. That's the story that they're committed to telling. They've set themselves up in a black and white scorched earth attitude against Christianity so that it is unable to enter their minds that mainstream Christianity used drugs. So they're confused about motivations and are not thinking about alternate possible motivations and alternate scenarios of the relation or role of drugs within mainstream Christianity. Is Eastern religion based on drugs? The one scholar has written at least that Tibetan is, and early original Buddhism in India is, and James Arthur wrote about the subject as one of many subjects he surveyed in his short, compacted survey book, Mushrooms and Mankind. Note there again the fallacy, the single drug plant fallacy, Mushrooms and Mankind. It should really be, the title should be, Visionary Plants and Mankind. I believe, based on the few investigators who have successfully found, oh, there's also Wasson finding that the Buddha figure in the story died of mushroom poisoning, which we should really think of as an ego death, I would say. From these brief yet successful forays into the question of the extent of drug use within Eastern religion, And knowing how the mind works and how efficacious drugs are, and recognizing the mythic themes, I conclude that Eastern religious practice originated from drugs and was historically normally based on drugs. It is false to think that historical Eastern religious practice was only in a deviant, exceptional cases based on drugs. It makes more sense to think that the norm, which who knows what percentage of people actually adhered to this logical norm, the logical norm is that genuine Eastern religion was based on drugs. It's very unlikely that it was normally based on 30 years of meditation. Most people hardly live half that long anyway. It's just rather absurd, this idea of people wasting and frittering away all their time when a short path is completely effective and exists. What are the differences between the theories or interests of Jan Ervin and Michael Hoffman? Jan Ervin focuses more on fertility cult and astrotheology as a primary driving interest, and it lacks the attention to hymarmony or fatedness which it certainly should have. He must at least comment on this subject. It's a very important, predominant concern in religion, and he has nothing to say on the subject at all, as though it's not important or present whatsoever, when in fact it's of primary presence and concern in the history of Western religion, and very much in Eastern religion as well. He also lacks the socio-political motivations of New Testament Christianity, which I have, including lacking a real focus on the king as initiate and the intertwining of mystical metaphors and political metaphors. How does the establishment treatment of topics shut out coverage of entheogens in religious history? By yelling Allegro and everyone clears the room. By acting as though Allegro must be and can only be considered the final word on the subject of the case in favor of the substantial role of entheogens in religious history, particularly in Christian origins. By acting as though Wasson, Tart, and Allegro and Huxley are the final possible word on the subject. Acting as though Wasson and Allegro have opened up and investigated the question of the extent of the use of drug plants in the history of Christianity, when in fact neither Wasson nor Allegro at all asked the extent of the role of entheogens in Christian history. The establishment treatment avoids the question of the Eucharist as that which induces the dissociative state, which then causes mental regeneration. The establishment treatment avoids looking at, there's a lot of negative here, look at what the establishment treatment amounts to not doing and not taking into consideration. Mushroom trees, wave those aside because of Panofsky. Only allow alternate states of consciousness to enter into Christian scholarship under the academic paradigm or uber paradigm of alien social psychology. Sometimes with a list of everything except drugs, saying that alien social psychology combined with fasting, hypnosis, contemplation, etc., etc., is what induced the alternate state of consciousness within the minds of original and early Christians. There I'm just recounting the establishment view and the topics that the establishment does take up into consideration. Now, how does it shut out coverage? By permitting only one controversial topic to be discussed at a time, thus preserving the overall framework by only enabling manipulating one piece of the puzzle at a time. In other words, thou shalt not do what Allegro did, which was to simultaneously assert no Jesus and the significant central role of drugs in Christian origins. What is the way forward so that the mainstream culture integrates the maximal entheogen theory of religion? Look at the authors who are closest to the maximal entheogen theory, and are closest to the ego death theory, and be in touch with them. Seek out your audience who is as most in agreement with you already as possible, and seek to bring them closer into greater intellectual coherence, and collect and organize the arguments and the evidence with a central focus on drugs in Christian history, but also surrounded by extra-Christian evidence as well. This needs to be text evidence, art evidence, and it needs to be arguments and scenarios. Never just pieces of evidence, because then people dream up absurd scenarios that are not actually necessary, they're not the only possible scenario, and there are better, more compelling, and consistent scenarios that provide greater explanatory power. What topics does the astrotheology book need to cover more? Heimarmony or fatedness? The political ultimate purpose of the New Testament? Drugs in Eastern religion? It could cover the entheogen versus meditation debate. It could cover the intermingling of mystical and political themes. Now, I don't expect that book to be identical to the ego-death theory. Does it do what it intends to do? On that basis, I would say that the main self-contradicting flaw and fault of the book is its omission of heimarmony. And I do consider it a flaw that it doesn't recognize and take up seriously the intermingling of political themes or mythemes with mystical themes or mythemes. Because in the most important Western religion, those themes were intertwined. And in Western culture too. And yet that book is bereft of the social-political aspect. Plus, it could benefit a lot from comparing ancient to modern intermingling of political and mystical religious realms. Should books and articles appeal to a popular audience or to a scholarly audience? Try to hit both to a substantial degree. Make it scholarly enough and popular enough. I consider Irvin to be a popular writer, whereas I think of myself as being not exactly popular or scholarly, but more pure theorist, leading-edge theorizing. It just goes way beyond scholarly and beyond popular. I'm almost this third category of the theorist audience. I write for androids. Are web-based scholars different than previous print-based scholars? Web-based scholars are more tapped in, patched in communication networks, more quick publishing. And Theos Magazine is sitting on a stack of 7 issues not published due to cost of print. Online is free distribution worldwide. In Theos Magazine, issues 1 through 3 have not been influential because they're print-based. Only the very latest couple scholars are web-based. They seem much younger, therefore, and much more attuned and capable in the new online environment. Next major category of questions is drugs in Christianity. What evidence is there that the original Christians used drugs? There is art evidence. There is text evidence. There is art evidence for extra-Christian use and later Christian use and later Western esotericism, both in texts and art. The arguments are, for example, what arguments are there that the original Christians used drugs? Arguments include the, we need a term for these scholars like John Pilch, Jonanda Groenwald, Marcus Borg. These scholars assert and point out, and also the book by Luke Timothy Johnson, Religious Experiencing in Earliest Christianity, they point out the evident presence of alternate states of consciousness, so-called, in Christian origins, and yet they refuse to consider the drug explanation of how these alternate states of consciousness were induced. Therefore, they have to dance around and try to avoid being pinned down, because when you pin them down, finally, it turns out that to avoid the drug hypothesis explanation, they have to instead explain that these alternate states of consciousness were induced through alien social psychology that was very impressed by ritual to the point of having an altered state, and based on so-called contemplation and mass hypnosis, and these other flaky, truly far-fetched explanations, when the truly simple and not far-fetched explanation is drugs. That's a key argument. Another key argument is that the Eucharist and liturgy in mainstream Christianity were strongly described in definitely drug-like terminology that fits and matches the use of drugs in other ancient religions, and the use of drugs in general, and contemporary cognitive experiencing and cognitive phenomena. There is a successful match. There is no problem with the drug hypothesis. The drug hypothesis fits. That's the argument. Another argument is that the religions all around surrounding Christianity used drugs, and there is no reason to assume that Christianity would be any different. Discuss the assertion that there's no need to assume drugs in primitive Christianity. The assertion is oddly worded, It is biased from the start, blatantly biased against drugs. It implies, without coming out and committing to this, to defending this position, it implies that drugs are a long shot without even discussing the question, and that drugs make less sense than simpler, more natural explanations like alien social psychology that was very impressed with ritual to the point of having an altered state by participating in ritual, and mass hypnosis and so-called contemplation, as though those are completely satisfactory and perfectly suitable and fitting explanations, whereas drugs would be a unnecessary long shot that would be less likely. That's the implication. It's a weaselly statement that implies a lot but doesn't actually have the gumption to stand behind its implications and actually argue the points. It segregates drugs into this category of long shot theories without even taking up the real critical argumentation. It segregates from the start drugs into a long shot category, while all other approaches are considered as preferable to drugs and natural. The statement is extremely biased. Of course, what matters here is not just the raw, stripped down statement in itself. The statement may look like a raw, stripped down statement, but it's actually a loaded and heavily packed statement where we really have to examine what we know that the speaker really actually has in mind when they say, in their biased fashion, there's no need to assume drugs in primitive Christianity. When we inspect statements, we have to very often make a clear distinction between the surface, literal sense of the statement versus the mental associations that are truly behind the statement and are covertly packed into the statement. Instead of a statement about a fact, it's really locking in and asserting an entire gigantic framework of assumptions. You can just tell, you can spin out and explain in great detail what the speaker believes on all kinds of things. You can tell that they're historicists, apologists. You can make a lot of guesses that are almost a sure bet about what other things that the person who asserts this would also assert. So it's really a handle. This statement actually should be treated as a handle on an entire standardized, gigantic framework of assumptions. You know that you're really not talking to one person regarding one statement. You know that what you're here grappling with really is an entire mindset and an entire paradigm, the establishment framework of assumptions and manner and mode of thinking, which is essentially what I mean when I say that the statement is intensely biased or loaded. That statement will be always found within entire paragraphs that we can readily imagine. Entire paragraphs. The sentence implies paragraphs, and the paragraphs imply a paradigm, which is the currently predominant establishment paradigm. So we're really talking here about one particular ear or corner of the establishment paradigm. The establishment paradigm would rather pick any far-fetched, really even nonsensical, they would rather pick a supernaturalist nonsensical and evasive hypothesis that's vague and evasive and implausible, like mass hypnosis. They would rather pick that, and also, of course, to do that, they have to ignore the history of the liturgy and the clearly entheogenic language used to talk about the Eucharist. They have to avoid talking about concrete, visualizable scenarios, whereas the drug theory is very concrete and readily lends itself to specific scenarios. Of course, the establishment framework will completely mess up and misrepresent that scenario, and usually relying on Allegro. Allegro, unfortunately, plays into the establishment paradigm. He provides a half-baked, distasteful, crooked, ill-formed version of the theory, and is thus very useful to the mainstream because they then will avoid the real treatment of the question of drugs in primitive Christianity, and will instead revert to Allegro version 1.0, as though that's the only possible version of the scenario. Thus, they use Allegro to avoid really critically discussing the various possible scenarios. Why should anyone care about whether drugs were used in primitive Christianity? It makes all the difference in the world, because if drugs were used predominantly in primitive Christianity, then that means that we can use drugs today to have the same experiences and figure out what primitive Christianity was all about, as the ego-death theory has done. If drugs are held not to have been used in primitive Christianity, but they in fact were, then we have no chance of understanding the nature of primitive Christianity and the meaning of the New Testament. The most important thing in the world is whether drugs were used in primitive Christianity and throughout Christian history. The most important question in the world is, to what extent were drugs used in the history of Christian practice? Was early Christianity a drug cult? No, early Christianity was the culturally standard use of drugs, as all religion of the time did, for the special distinctive purpose of setting up an alternate socio-political society within the society, or state within a state. Early Christianity incorporated drug use, as did all religions of the era, of the entire antiquity. All ancient religion was drug cult, including imperial theology and imperial ruler cult, and the imperial mysteries. They all were drug cults. Ancient religion as a whole and uniformly was a drug cult. Christianity was utterly ununique in this. The only thing that was different about Christianity was its use of the drug experiences deliberately spun as certain political configuration differently than how the imperial religion spun its use of drug experiencing to prop up the official social political system. To what extent were drugs used in the history of Christian practice? Drugs were used ubiquitously and normally in Christian origins, just like in all ancient religion, and they continued to be used very heavily and normally in mainstream Christian practice until the beginning of the modern era, around 1700. Drug use in Christianity declined around 1700 to some extent, not around the year 323. All entheogen scholars have been saying that drugs were used somewhat in early Christianity, but were immediately heavily suppressed, almost to nothing, only used in secret, deviant, heretical, or elite, exceptional cases after 323, or after the year 70, say, or even after the year 50, say, per Allegro. Thus, they drop down their distribution usage curve far too early, contradicting the evidence. The evidence from Eucharistic liturgy and Christian art and extra-Christian texts and art indicates that drug use did not drop to near zero, even in mainstream Christianity, but it stayed heavily, fairly high all the way through the Middle Ages until the modern era. Can No Jesus scholars safely ignore the question of drugs and Christian origins? No. For explanatory coherence, the No Jesus idea, theory, hypothesis must be integrated with the role of drugs and the scenarios of drug use in Christian origins. Only by combining the two does a coherent, sensible, clear-headed explanation that's plausible actually come into view. How important is mystical enlightenment without any consideration of political topics? Not very important historically because, well, it's as important as Western esotericism, much of which wasn't particularly political. The New Testament is more political than most Western esotericism. That is what is so distinctive about the New Testament, and what is very likely the reason for the continued resurgence and popularity of the New Testament and the New Testament version of Western religion and the New Testament version of Christianity throughout Western history up till the modern age. Irvin covers mystical enlightenment, but not political topics. He explains mystic enlightenment to an extent. He explains some of the surface complexifying esotericism symbology used to express religion, but doesn't really delve below that to the cognitive functioning of what's intended by and cognitive revelations and phenomenology of what's intended by those myths. I don't see him bridging the esotericism myths to the dissociative state cognitive phenomenology. When I talk about mystical enlightenment, I have in mind more my phase one as being mystical enlightenment, whereas I don't see Irvin as quite attaining to a theory of mystical enlightenment. It is more a theory, a surface theory of symbolic practice, symbolic religious practice, saying that fertility cult and entheogens were normal part of esotericism practice. But I don't see his book so much as a theory of mystical enlightenment in terms of cognitive phenomenology. When gauging the importance of mystical enlightenment, aside from politics, it's unclear on what an example of such a focus on mystical enlightenment is represented by. What's a good example of it? There's my theory, which is certainly a good example in a certain sense. Well, if you leave out the political topics, then you may have some sort of an explanation of what Christian practices were or what Christianity was about, such as astrotheology, fertility, and drug use. But that's about it. That kind of limit of explanation is there. The mere fact that those things were of interest and that there was symbology talking about those or referring to those. Whereas New Testament Christianity was driven primarily and distinctively by its political or social political focus. The New Testament considers those two as vying against each other almost for central importance, and ultimately it fuses them together to build up each other mutually, using mystical enlightenment to build up the social political values and using social political themes to build up the values of mystical enlightenment. The political rules the world. That's like an old 60s question of whether to battle politically or to battle in mystically. But the New Testament is so venerable because it integrates both and intertwines both. And once you can follow and trace the intertwining of mystical themes and the political themes or social themes, then you master esoteric symbology and metaphorical description. Is New Testament Christianity more important than purely mystical Christianity because of including a political vector on the mystical insights? Yes, Freak and Gandhi cover purely mystical Christianity in its, for example, in its Gnostic content, whereas New Testament Christianity is more important than only understanding the purely mystical aspect. Thus, Freak provides a preliminary and prolegomenon, a preliminary explanation of the mystical content of Christianity insofar as he can, short of lacking the political and social themes. You can't understand purely mystical Christianity, as in the New Testament, without also having an understanding of how that is intertwined with the political and social themes and mythemes and metaphors. How are mainstream Christian history scholars going to be brought to start thinking about and conceptualizing the topic of drug use in Christian origins and history? Similar to the question, what is the way forward so that the mainstream culture integrates the maximal entheogen theory of religion? Meet them on their own ground and in their own terms as much as possible. Be in contact with the theorists, the Christian history scholars who are closest to the topic of drug use in Christian origins and history. Show them that they have not specified how. They've only really specified that the alternate states of consciousness were important to early Christians and present, but they have not effectively made a case for how those alternate states were induced, and they certainly have not made a case or even taken up the question of which was more plausible and likely as far as ways of inducing these things. Alien social psychology combined with some sort of ritual and mass hypnosis versus drugs. Which one indeed really is the more far-fetched and artificial and implausible explanation of how the alternate states were induced among early Christians? Also, the topic of historicity comes in here, because when we picture the drug-using early Christians or the alternate state experiencing early Christians, are we to picture them in a literalist way as drawn from the Eusebian history, reading the New Testament literalistically? Or are we to picture the New Testament as a more literary, fictional description of these early Christians? So who are we explaining when we're talking about scenarios of drug use by early Christians? Are we literalistically picturing the apostles and Jesus himself using the drugs? That will lead to confusion, compounding implausibilities, leading to an overall misty, glowing picture that loses touch with concrete reality. Write a book for that audience. Criticize them. Show out their weaknesses. Make them look ridiculous. Offer them a better alternative and a more commitment-worthy scenario reconstruction. The issues involve converting them both in terms of historicity and in terms of drug use. Are John Pilch, Jonanda Groenwald, Marcus Borg, John Ashton, and Stephen Davies on the right track? Can they be converted from their standard academic alien social psychology theory of alternate states of consciousness to the simpler drug use theory? They are susceptible and vulnerable to being convinced because they are interested in the alternate states of consciousness, and I have done decades worth of leading edge idea development in this area that is irresistible to those scholars in that field. I'm saying the same thing they are, except more so, going further than they do, taking what they say for granted, readily taking up everything they're asserting, and pushing it much further. Yes, they can be converted. Yes, they are on the right track. Show them the implausibilities and unrealities in their thinking and in their analysis. Show them, write for them, show them, communicate with them the light years ahead alternate historical revisionist theory that follows its own song, its own muse, and is not compromising. They are forced to heavily compromise. They can't even think about Allegro, whereas I can actually go so far as to criticize Allegro, actually engaging with him, and actually retaining his key ideas while continuing to throw away and overturn the scenario of Allegro version 1.0. I'm there rejecting Allegro. I'm correcting Allegro. But Irvin's approach won't do it because it's not focused enough or dedicated enough to the New Testament and to Christian liturgy and early Christian history. The focus there is too narrowly on John Allegro and the early Christians, whereas I've taken on theology and the breadth of Christian history and Christian thinking, not just Christian esotericism, but the New Testament and what it means and what it meant in its context, and tracing the maximal and theogen theory of Christianity within the context of the maximal and theogen theory of late antiquity, which I introduced Irvin to after he wrote his book. For example, he said that to me on the phone that slaves would have been ignorant in late antiquity of the entheogenic nature of the mixed wine but I pointed out that they were the ones who mixed it and served it, and it was just plain unrealistic to imagine that the slaves who prepared and administered the mixed wine somehow had no familiarity with it or were somehow shut out of the room or whatever. That absolutely contradicts everything in the reports and in the cultural scenes that we are given. For example, who served or acted as the horses, the bouncers in the symposium banqueting. That would have been slaves. They would have been intimately familiar with talking down the mixed wine recipient. You would certainly want your horses or bouncers to be familiar with the mixed wine. And the whole idea that slaves were somehow culturally segregated off just does not hold up for one moment. So I'm the one who started really exposing Irvin and everyone to the maximal and theogen theory. James Arthur, I would say, and possibly Heinrich, are generally attuned to this way of thinking that I call the maximal and theogen theory of religion. Definitely, I am certainly, no one questions that I'm the one who bandies about and created the phrase the maximal and theogen theory of religion and wrote a webpage defining and specifying the differences between the minimal, moderate, and maximal and theogen theories. So it is very true to say that I am the creator of the maximal and theogen theory of religion as a rebuttal to the more lukewarm, half-baked, moderate and theogen theory of religion, and especially an alternative to the really darkened view of the minimal theory. Those scholars like Pilch and Groenwald and Borg and Ashton and Davies are on the right track, but they are confused due to their retaining the notion of reading the New Testament as literal historical reportage with the historical Jesus and historical Paul, they are intensely compromised with the establishment Christian framework and history and paradigm. They are trying to bring in the alternate states idea into the establishment paradigm. Luke Timothy Johnson merely describes it as the religious experiencing topic as a missing dimension, as though he can simply add religious experiencing, meaning direct primary religious experiencing, into the existing predominant Christianity, Christian origins paradigm. But I have no such compromising that I'm obliged to do, compromising with the mainstream paradigm. I throw that out and create a wholly new, fresh paradigm that combines N.T. Wright's fresh paradigm on Paul, or fresh perspective on Paul, that is, Jesus and Paul as counter-political figures, combining that so-called fresh perspective with the entheogen theory in its maximal form. R. Gordon Wasson and John M. Allegro. Wasson and Allegro. Why is Wasson so important? What if we subtract and ignore him? Wasson is important because he is the first to write a whole book on entheogen origins of religion, specifically Vedic religion and the textual tree in the text of Genesis and in Mexican religion. That's why he's important. If we subtracted and ignored him, we would not have opened the door at that time on the history of drug use in religious practice, in religious origins, as he would always emphasize, pushing it back in time, limiting it to antiquity, ancient antiquity, prehistory. Wasson can be called the father of entheobotany or ethno-entheo something or other. He's the father, but an imperfect father that also held back the field from developing as far as it should have and as fast as it should have. He put the brakes on even raising the question of drug use in Jewish Christian religion after Genesis tree was authored. His statements assert that the Jewish Christian religion did not use entheogens after the beginning of Genesis was written. Why is Allegro so important? What if we subtract and ignore him? Allegro was the first to combine or attempt to combine no Jesus with use of drugs in Christian origins and to look for those in the New Testament. He is considered important in a dismissive way by mainstream scholarship whenever the question of drugs in Christianity or the question of no Jesus is raised. They simply stamp those ideas as Allegro, meaning Allegro version 1.0, and dismiss them. Thus, Allegro is used as a foil to preserve as a familiar opponent to preserve who is used or abused as a means of preserving the establishment worldview and avoiding and heading off and tabooing the idea dismissively of no Jesus and the idea of drugs in Christian origins. That's why he is important, and those are some senses in which he is treated as if important. What if we subtract and ignore Allegro? We would lack his linguistic research. We would lack him as a common familiar point of reference. There would be advantages, too, if he didn't exist or if his book was not published on Sacred Mushroom. It would be good if he had put out initially the maximal entheogen theory and opened up and called for other scholars to really truly open up the question of the maximal entheogen theory, but that would be too much to ask. He didn't have the first-hand dissociative state experiences himself, and he made the familiar mistake of drawing down the distribution curve too quickly, even using that to explain that using the sudden complete forgetting of entheogens in Christianity as the explanation of why the second generation of Christians, so to speak, made the mistake of literalizing Jesus and forgot that he didn't exist. As though if they had the entheogens, then they would have. And that's just garbled. How was Wasson great? How did he limit or cripple the field? I've covered that. Allegro limited the field by his uninformed view on entheogens, his monoplant focus on the Amanita, his presenting of a version 1 scenario which assumed that the culture of late antiquity did not use entheogens or mushrooms, and that Christianity was distinctive. He was completely wrong in that. drastically wrong in assuming that Christianity was somehow unique or distinctive in its use of entheogens or mushrooms. He didn't really have the concept of entheogens, and he didn't have the concept that the Roman Empire ubiquitously used entheogens. So he had his hypothesis of secrecy, secret drug cult, which Ruck has in spirit continued to maintain even as Ruck has been pulled more and more towards the maximal theory due to the sheer frequency and bulk of evidence that Ruck himself has found. What will be retained of Wasson? Certainly not his views on Jewish-Christian use of drugs after Genesis. His general principle will be retained of the origin, drug origin of religion, including Vedic and Mexico. He will be corrected. He has been corrected on Irish religion by Peter Lamborn Wilson, the book Ploughing the Clouds. And Letcher has a little to contribute towards rejecting certain things about Wasson, or things that Wasson asserted. Wasson's assertion of the moderate entheogen theory will be rejected in favor of the maximal theory. In other words, he draws his distribution curve down too soon, standard error of almost all entheogen scholars, which is contradicted by the latest evidence that shows clearly that entheogen use was normal, standard, mainstream, predominant, not deviant and rare and all but completely suppressed. What will be retained of Allegro? His fertility aspects will be retained, but not in the New Testament. His astrotheology, I don't believe he has astrotheology. His notion of secrecy in about drug use will not be retained. His picture of Roman imperial culture not using drugs will be rejected. His sheer idea that there was no Jesus will be retained, and that the apostles were non-historical will be retained, but the notion that the apostles and Jesus, well, his ideas about linguistic references to mushrooms or entheogens, those will, I think, largely be retained. I don't depend on them in any way myself. So his bare ideas of no Jesus, but drug use by early Christians, those will be retained, but much of his other scenario ideas will be rejected. His linguistic connections will largely be retained, and his fertility connections will largely be retained, but not in the New Testament significantly. Why bother setting the record straight on the errors of Wasson and the merit of some of Allegro's ideas? The field of entheogen scholarship and entheogen theory and the theory of religion is all held back by Allegro version 1.0 and the scholarly ideas about Allegro and about, therefore, drugs and no Jesus. It is mandatory and necessary to set the record straight on the merit of some of Allegro's ideas because of his negative importance in the minds of mainstream scholars. We cannot have religious revelation and insight until we deal with the Allegro, straightening out the Allegro mess. We cannot understand the New Testament or Jesus, the origin of that figure, or even the nature of the psychedelic experience. Along with that, it's crucial to set the record straight on the errors of Wasson because he's treated as too much all or nothing, same as Allegro, positively but negatively, in the one case versus the other. It's important to eliminate Wasson's errors, his thought that Jewish Christian religion didn't use drugs after Genesis was authored. What should a book cover that has chapters on Wasson and Allegro? The topics described above, at least the bare points that were made above, and a call to move beyond Wasson and Allegro. They are not the final word.